to anything more than minor corruption. You know, maybe building a Trump hotel in Red Square or something like that, but nothing of any significance. The Democrats invested everything in this issue. Well, turned out there was nothing much there. They gave Trump a huge gift. In fact, they may have handed him the next election. That's a matter of being so unwilling to deal with fundamental issues that they're looking for something on the side that'll somehow give political success. The real issues are different things. There are things like climate change, like global warming, nuclear posture review, deregulation. These are real issues, but the Democrats aren't going after those. They're looking for something else. The Democratic establishment. I'm not talking about the young cohort that's coming in, which is quite different. All of that has to be shifted significantly if there's going to be a legitimate political opposition to the right-wing drift that's taking place. And it can happen, can definitely happen, but it's going to take work.
Noam Chomsky speaking at the Old South Church in Boston in April. And that does it for the show. If you'd like to get a copy, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Caron, Hani Massoud, Tarina Nadura, Tamari Astudio, and Libby Rainey. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Nogueira are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grand, David Prude, Ishmael Darrow, Vesta Godarz, and Carl Marxer. And to our camera crew, John Randolph, Karen Meadows, Anna Osbeck, and Matt Ely. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
I want to thank my mommy for loving me so much.
For taking me to the doctor when I broke my foot.
For leaving me alone when I wanted to be alone.
And now, as a grown-up, I'm thankful for being able to take care of you, my dear mom. For taking you to your therapies. For understanding that sometimes you simply want to be alone.
Roles change without us noticing. That's why AARP gives you the information to provide even better care for your loved one. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Enrollment is now open for Henry Ford College fall classes, which begin Thursday, August 22nd. For more information and to register, please visit our website, hfcc.edu. You can also call HFC at 313-845-9600. See you on campus!
Henry Ford College is a smoke-free campus. Henry Ford College supports and is committed to wellness and a healthy environment. No person shall smoke, chew, or use tobacco, tobacco products, vaping, or smoking simulation products on campus, with the exception of use in private vehicles. Use of recreational marijuana, however, is strictly prohibited anywhere on campus. The HFC smoke-free policy applies to all faculty, staff, students, vendors, contractors, and visitors to our campus. For more information on the HFC smoke-free policy, visit policies.hfcc.edu.
Hey guys, this is Bill. Yes, I am your host of the Doghouse Blues Show, asking you to join me every Monday at 4 o'clock right here on WHFR Radio for some drive home good time blues music. Let me relieve your frustration, your aggravation, and the tension that has built up through the day. Be with me each and every Monday at 4 o'clock as we bring the blues to the doghouse.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn, listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
From the Center for Documentary Studies and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.
I think we're in another transition, a big transition.
This is Travels with Mike, in search of America 50 years after Steinbeck.
He set off with a dog going looking for America. I don't know if he found it.
Half a century ago, writer John Steinbeck took his dog Charlie and drove for 3 months The result was his last major book, Travels with Charlie. In Travels with Mike, that is, the microphone, we retrace Steinbeck's journey.
I hope you don't mind walking.
Guided by a diverse array of today's artists.
My take on North Dakota is a result of having spent my whole life here.
There's a lot of desperation right now. People are really concerned.
We are always breaking down and building back up as humans and as communities.
In the coming hour, Travels with Mike, a journey through the spirit of America. But first, this news.
Are you a local artist? Would you like to hear your music on WHFR? Please send us your music for airplay consideration. You can find our email and physical mailing addresses at whfr.fm. Don't wait. Send your MP3s, CDs, and records today.
Techno, trance, house, and dance music. What does it all have in common? Well, for starters, you can hear all four of these genres of electronic music and more spun live by local DJs every single week on the show that we call The Mix. My name is Bam, and you can join me along with different local DJs and groups like Detroit Deep Sessions, Latin Image Entertainment, and The Wax Kings this and every single Thursday from 9 p.m. to midnight. Since 2004, my show has been making beats on the only station that's making waves, WHFR.
Hi, this is Mike White from the Projection Booth, and I love college radio stations like WHFR because that is the place where you hear the real deal. The music that you can't hear on other radio stations, they can't hear on terrestrial, satellite, any other kind of radio stations that they have these days. Not even like podcasts and Spotify and that kind of stuff, because this is real radio going on here. You hear real people playing you some of their favorite songs. You're not hearing this kind of malarkey that you hear on other stations. You don't hear the radio spots that you hear on other stations that just drive you up a friggin' wall. You hear the real thing. And that's why I love college radio, and that's why I love WHFR. Personally, I'll tell you, I'm a frustrated college radio DJ, and so I loved the days when I was playing a whole bunch of what they call experimental music, things that you're not going to hear, like I said, anyplace else. You're not going to hear Eugene Chadbourne burning up the charts on anything but college radio, and that's why you should listen to WHFR.
It's Thursday night, and you're grabbing drinks with some friends. Started off with a pitcher for the table, which quickly becomes two. There's pool. And there's the photo booth.
All right, everybody squeeze in. Say cheese!
Followed naturally by an order of wings. And another.
Can we get some extra ranch sauce?
Then there's the ceremonial nightcap.
So what are we doing this weekend?
And lastly, it's back to the car, which, if you're buzzed... could be the most expensive night of your life. Getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
From the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.
We are standing on the dock of Steinbeck's house. It's a pier that juts out into the bay.
We're in the Faubourg Marigny area of New Orleans.
So we're in downtown Monterey.
Okay, we're going to be into the Redwoods here.
This is Travels with Mike, in search of America 50 years after Steinbeck.
Yeah, 1960 when Steinbeck came through.
He drove through Fargo-Moorhead.
As part of his journey, he comes home again.
He comes to a small area outside of Spokane and finds a little place to stay.
He pulled off as we just did, probably in this exact spot 50 years ago.
I'm Al Letson, and usually I host a show called State of the Reunion from NPR and PRX. But in this special broadcast, I'm pleased to be your host as we revisit a famous trip taken half a century ago by writer John Steinbeck and take our own journey here in the 20-teens into the spirit of America. In 1960, John Steinbeck was in his late 50s and his health was shaky. He'd achieved all he could as a novelist, having written, among other things, The Grapes of Wrath, Of Mice and Men, and East of Eden. He felt the need for an adventure, and he wrote, he found himself out of touch.
For many years, I have traveled in many parts of the world. In America, I live in New York, or dip into Chicago or San Francisco. But New York is no more America than Paris is France, or London is England. Thus, I discovered that I did not know my own country.
So, Steinbeck took his standard poodle, Charlie, and climbed into a makeshift camper truck that he named Rocinante, after Don Quixote's horse. The rider and his dog set out for 3 months. They made a 10,000-mile loop from one coast to the other and then back again. Steinbeck wrote down his experiences, some real and maybe some imagined, in his iconic book, Travels with Charlie in Search of America. It was published in 1962, the same year that Steinbeck won the Nobel Prize for Literature. In Travels with Mike, well, we're leaving the dog at home. Instead, producer John Bewin took a stereo microphone, that's Mike, and traveled to some key spots on Steinbeck's itinerary. In each place, he collaborated with an artist who lives and works there. Those diverse artists, they'll take turns guiding us on this journey. They reflect on Steinbeck's discoveries and talk back at him across time. John Steinbeck's point of departure, and ours, is Sag Harbor, New York. It's a very old fishing village near the tip of Long Island. Steinbeck lived there in 1960. The painter, David Slater, shows us around.
We are standing on the dock of Steinbeck's house. It's a pier that juts out into the bay, and I don't use this phrase usually, but it is a picture-perfect day. The sun is dappling off the water. This is the time after the tourists have left that people really love and can enjoy themselves and enjoy the freedom from all the traffic and noise. My name is David Slater. I am 70 years old. I'm an artist. I grew up on Long Island. I've lived in Sag Harbor for 28 years, and I love it here. In my little corner
of the world. Well, we're walking out on a little piece of land. This is the furthest extension of this point towards a very tiny house. It's a hexagonal gazebo. This is where he would go and write. I mean, he just wanted to be alone, and I understand this as an artist. Sometimes that's your most precious thing. Oh, here it is in the ground. A-R-O-Y-N-T, aroint, which means go away. And I think it's from, it's Old English. And I think it's from one of Shakespeare's plays.
I am reading from the beginning of Travels with Charlie. I, an American writer writing about America, was working from memory.
I, an American writer writing about America, was working from memory. And the memory is at best a faulty, warpy reservoir. I had not heard the speech of America, smelled the grass and trees and sewage, seen its hills and water, its color and quality of light. I knew the changes only from books and newspapers. But more than this, I had not felt the country for 25 years. When I laid the ground plan for my journey, there were definite questions to which I wanted matching answers. I suppose they could all be lumped into the single question, what are Americans like today?
1960 really was a big transition, or the 60s, early 60s. Americans now are, I think we're in another transition, a big transition, and people are not really sure what Americans are like. There's a lot of desperation right now. People are very, you know, really concerned. A young man, Lance Corporal Jordan Herter, I remember seeing him walk around the streets in Sag Harbor, just a high school kid, joined the Marines, deployed in Iraq for you know, 3 weeks, and a vehicle came down the road. He suspected that it was a suicide bomber. He opened fire on the vehicle. He killed the driver, kept the vehicle from going any further into the compound, which would have killed about 30 more people. But in the explosion of this dynamite-filled vehicle, he was killed. And the emotional response to this guy in this town is so intense. They had a parade, and his body came through here, and they, you know, and he was honored. He was the first casualty killed in battle since World War II from Sag Harbor. I think that part of the reason that Steinbeck liked Sag Harbor is he found working people here who, they were more real to him. And in the world of art, and I'm sure it's the same is true in literature, there's a certain elitism and snobism. And he said, I'm just a working man myself. My work is that I write. I call myself a full-time artist, and I call myself a full-time worker in other fields. So I'm actually working two full-time jobs simultaneously. I just started to work with the work that was available, and a lot of it is in the building trades. Did house painting, my first recognition as a painter. I need a new car. People think that if you live in Sag Harbor or you're from this area, that you're rich. And we're standing within less than 100 yards of where a friend of mine lives out in a dumpster. There are poor people, myself included. I mean, I've had some rough times due to the recession. For a couple of winters, I've had to go to the food pantry to get food. I had read Steinbeck a lot in the 50s and all of the major works, and was especially blown away by Grape's Wrath, which is apparently, you know, considered, I guess, to be his masterpiece. I think Steinbeck would be horrified at the age we live in now. This is the central flagpole in the village of Sag Harbor. Right after the September 11th event, I did a painting about September 11th. And one of the collage elements that I put onto this was a piece of this flag that had torn off the top. You can see the top of the flag is frayed. It's very heavy wind up there. I collaged it onto my canvas. This is another passage from the book Travels with Charlie.
I pulled Rosinante into a small picnic area maintained by the state of Connecticut and got out my book of maps. And suddenly, the United States became huge beyond belief and impossible ever to cross. I wondered how in hell I'd got myself mixed up in a project that couldn't be carried out. It was like starting to write a novel. When I faced the desolate impossibility of writing 500 pages, a sick sense of failure falls on me, and I know I can never do it. So it was now, as I looked at the bright colored projection of Monster America.
That's a passage from John Steinbeck's 1962 book, Travels with Charlie. And we heard from painter David Slater in Sag Harbor, New York. You're listening to Travels with Mike, a journey into the America of John Steinbeck's time and our own. I'm Al Letson. When Steinbeck hit the road with Charlie, he drove across the northern tier of the country, then back through the south. In retracing his journey, we're taking some liberties. We're going to move across the country just once from east to west. So next up, New Orleans. Steinbeck stopped there in the fall of 1960 to witness history, public school desegregation, and the bitter response of some white folk. Our guide in New Orleans was a child then. He watched that drama unfold up close and personal day after day.
We're in the Faubourg Marigny area of New Orleans. It's immediately across the street from the French Quarter. We're sitting in Washington Park. It's a one square block green space in one corner, swings and things for children. And what you hear in the background are school children who are here.
It's hard to imagine that anybody would want all of these kids to fail, or some of these kids to fail, or any of these kids to fail. But if all of the young people in this part graduated from high school in 5 years, all of them could not work in New Orleans, commensurate with their education.
This is my story.
My name is Kalamu Yasalam.
This is my song.
I am a writer, educator, and filmmaker.
I will sing these here blues, though they done stole my tongue.
Yeah, in 1960, when Steinbeck came through, I was born in 1947. I was 13 years old. He came to look at France School and what was happening there. And France was an elementary school where integration, what some people would say forced integration, was going on.
Late in 1960, Steinbeck wrote, the incident most reported and pictured in the newspapers was the matriculation of a couple of tiny Negro children in a New Orleans school.
Behind these small dark mites were the law's majesty and the law's power to enforce. Both the scales and the sword were allied with the infants, while against them were 300 years of fear and anger and terror of change in a changing world.
This bitter earth, well, what the fruit it bears.
When France happened, the school I went to, Rivers Frederick Jr. High School, was located in the 7th Ward. I lived in the lower 9th Ward. In order to get to school, I would catch a bus, the Galvez bus. And the Galvez bus passed right in front of France School. So we saw what was going on there. And one of the guys that rode the bus with us was in the band. And for about a week, instead of carrying a trombone in his case, he carried a shotgun, because it had become just that dangerous.
What made the newsmen love the story?
What made the newsmen love the story was a group of stout, middle-aged women who, by some curious definition of the word mother, gathered every day to scream invectives at children. No newspaper had printed the words these women shouted, but now I heard the words, bestial and filthy and degenerate. These were not mothers, not even women. They were crazy actors playing to a crazy audience.
To a crazy audience. Steinbeck is doing what many of us do. When we see something that we find horrific, first thing we do is dehumanize it. And the second thing we do is pretend it's not us. When the truth is that one major part of the human condition is the ability to be inhuman. And all humans have that within them. And we must struggle with that.
We're walking on Frenchman towards the river.
I was born by the river.
The river that way! I believe that this country has made tremendous legal developments. There's a big difference between segregation being legal and segregation being illegal. Is that big difference addressing the problem? No. Here's a soundbite for you. Race was never the problem in America. That was a symptom of the problem. The problem was the economic appropriation and exploitation of land and labor. Those who owned never intended to share. And so instead of sharing, what they did was told you, then black people's your problem.
Sometimes you start something and it stops.
So I did this album called My Story, My Song. A series of duets with New Orleans musicians whom I knew. Walter Washington, who was a blues musician, who was playing tonight on Frenchman Street, the street we just passed.
This is called Unfinished Blues.
This is John Steinbeck, travels with Charlie in search of America. He set off with a dog going looking for America. I don't know if he found it.
I have not intended to present, nor do I think I have presented, any kind of cross-section so that a reader can say he thinks he has presented a true picture of the South. I don't. I've only told what a few people said to me and what I saw. I don't know whether they were typical or whether any conclusion can be drawn. But I do know it is a troubled place and a people caught in a jam. And I know that the solution, when it arrives, will not be easy or simple.
That was writer Kalamu Yasalam of New Orleans, and the words of another writer who visited that city 50 years ago, John Steinbeck. I'm Al Edson, and this is Travels with Mike. Microphone in hand, we are following the footsteps of John Steinbeck a half a century after Travels with Charlie. In his novels and in Travels with Charlie, Steinbeck often wrote about social issues, ethnic and racial tolerance, economic justice, but he also wrote about more lyrical themes, like the contour of the land and romance versus reality. North Dakota is the very center of the North American continent. Steinbeck wrote that he'd always imagined the Dakota flatlands as exotic, almost otherworldly, until he went there.
We've now turned west and we're going over the Red River at the north. And it starts about 40 miles south of here and it goes.
My name is Wayne Goodmanson. I'm a photographer, a landscape photographer. I was born in Fargo, North Dakota in 1949.
But this is the route in 60 the Steinbeck would have traveled, except I don't think the interstate was done then, so he would have been on the road that this is sitting on top of and occasionally runs alongside of, which was Highway 10.
John Steinbeck in his Travels with Charlie introduced Fargo like this. Fargo to me is brother to the fabulous places of the earth, kin to those magically remote spots mentioned by Herodotus, Marco Polo, and Mandeville.
From my earliest memory, if it was a cold day, Fargo was the coldest place on the continent. If heat was the subject, then at that time the papers listed Fargo as hotter than any place else, or wetter or drier or deeper in snow.
You know, they jokingly say you can stand on a beer can in Fargo and see Grand Forks, which is 90 miles away, because it's just that flat.
And he continues, I must admit that when I passed through Moorhead, Minnesota,
and rattled across the Red River into Fargo on the other side, it was a golden autumn day, the town as traffic-troubled, as neon-plastered, as cluttered and milling with activity as any other up-and-coming town of 46,000 souls. It's bad to have one's myth shaken up like that.
And here's the ever-present north wind. Now, you don't have much in photography except literally where you stand and what you put next to what. So I'm moving around till these tire tracks align with the tower and this great old vintage camper.
My take on North Dakota is a result of having spent my whole life here, seeing it in all the seasons and seeing it in all of my seasons.
It's next to this cornfield is probably 6 feet high.
And so I've had the long look at it. That gives one a very different take than someone who's traveling through.
Oh, here we are. Exit 314. We are turning. This is where Steinbeck, he drove through Fargo-Moorhead, and he saw the sign for Alice and said, what a great name. I'm going to Alice. He pulled off, as we just did, probably in this exact spot, some almost 50 years ago.
Alone, so alone that I could cry. I wanna be one.
I remember one time showing my work in Manhattan at the Museum of Modern Art, and one of the assistant curators was looking at my open landscapes. And I could see that he was uncomfortable. And finally he sort of blurted out, "No, wait a minute, the town's behind you, right?" And I said, "In this photograph, you mean?" He said, "Yeah, yeah. Well, you're on the edge of the town, right?" And I said, "No, no, it looks like this, you know, in all four directions." So he felt very uncomfortable out there. And then, I mean, I know people who've grown up here who look at that openness as opportunity. I mean, you can do anything. You can go any direction you want. Wonderful. This is beautiful hollyhocks, 10 feet high, next to the hog shed where they repair old motorcycle hogs. Howdy. Doing good. So how long have you been in business doing motorcycle repair?
3 months ago, and down in Phoenix, and worked at Colorado Springs Harley, and just don't like the big city.
A writer named John Steinbeck came through Alice.
Oh?
Yeah, and he wrote about stopping at some camping area not too far from here, because isn't the Maple River just west of here?
Just west. Right down in Enderlin, you drive right to
it. Oh, that'd be the place to catch it.
Yeah, there's a park right along it, right on it.
Good talking to you.
Yeah, if you just go south 7-8 miles, you'll run into a stop sign. That'll be Highway 46. You hang a right, 3 miles.
Wonderful character. Great tattoos, wonderfully scruffy beard. I like driving the gravel roads, driving with the radio off, being able to stop wherever you want, stop the car in the middle of the road, get out, and just stare for a while out there until you can kind of make some sense of what's in front of you. So it has a lot to do with appreciation of place. I try to apply some level of, if you will, visual democracy. So all things have some form or shape. One is not better than another. Be it the railroad, be it the way roads were made, or the way farms were built, but just look at them simply as marks on the surface of the earth. Yeah, I don't have much money, but I'd bet a good chunk of it. This is where Steinbeck was 50 years ago, which in itself is kind of a nice thought. Were you here then, you would see this little pickup with this camper and this poodle down there, and this guy with a goatee out there having a cup of coffee with a little bourbon bump on the back. I'm sitting on this park bench right here. This is probably very similar to the one that he sat on here. He meets this itinerant performer, Shakespearean actor, and he has this exchange, and he spends more time talking to this person who may have existed or didn't exist, but all in a way of making a comment about America and maybe Americans, and the nature of the place. And the actor is now speaking. And he says, you know, when show people come into what they call the sticks, they have a contempt for the yokels. It took me a little time, but when I learned there aren't any yokels, I began to get on fine. I learned respect for my audience. And I think that's the message. I think that's what that character was meant to say about people. On Steinbeck's travels, he wrapped up his summation of Fargo this way. And I found with joy that the fact of Fargo had in no way disturbed my mind's picture of it.
I could still think of Fargo as I always had, blizzard-riven, heat-blasted, dust-rattled. I am happy to report that in the war between reality and romance, reality is not the stronger.
A reading from Travels with Charlie, the 1962 book by John Steinbeck, and in Eastern North Dakota that was photographer Wayne Goodmanson. I'm Al Letson. Coming up in the second half of the hour, we head further west to the edge of the Rocky Mountains and to Redwoods Country in Northern California. Steinbeck tries to go home again, and it doesn't go so well.
Steinbeck realized if the discussion continued, it was going to lead to a fight, that the next words were going to be, "Let's step outside and settle this." and later on talks about how he not only leaves Monterey, but in a sense flees Monterey.
You can see a map of the places we're visiting this hour and photos of the collaborating artists at TravelsWithMike, that's MIKE.org. Travels with Mike is a production of the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. From PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Welcome back. You're listening to Travels with Mike, In Search of America 50 Years After Steinbeck. I'm Al Edson, and we're taking a journey to places that the writer John Steinbeck visited a half a century ago on his cross-country trip with his dog. The trip led to his last major book, Travels with Charlie. Steinbeck wrote that he wanted to know, what are Americans like today? One thing you could probably say about Americans at the dawn of the 1960s, most straight people were not comfortable with homosexuality. When Steinbeck wrote on the topic in Travels with Charlie, he never said explicitly what he was talking about, but it's pretty clear. Near Spokane, Washington, just west of the Rocky Mountains, Steinbeck met a gruff man and his 20-year-old son, Robbie. 50 years later, we meet a Spokane native who has a lot in common with Robbie, except, luckily for Troy Nickerson, he was born 25 years later.
This is the main stage. What is this seat, David? 300 and something like that? 350-something? This is David Baker. He's one of the scenic designers at the theater. Civic's been around, I think, 60 years. Is that right, about 60 years?
Good. How are y'all feeling? A little bit of zaw, 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 zaw.
I'm Troy Nickerson. I was born in 1965, born and raised in Spokane. I'm a hairdresser and a director of community theater, some professional theater, and a choreographer. This is the set for Annie, Get Your Gun.
Just go from the big stuff, just when I start singing. There's no...
Yeah, all right, let's start at the chair.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Are you ready?
There's no business like show business. I grew up in this theater. My first show, I believe, I was 13. My brother was always kind of a sports dude, and I was just kind of drawn to it, and did tons of shows, and then they asked me to direct Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, I think basically because nobody else wanted to, and I did it, and it turned out really well, and I've been kind of directing almost every year since then. So in Steinbeck's travels, he comes to a small area outside of Spokane and finds a little place to stay, where he meets a flamboyant young man named Robbie and his father.
Young emotion.
There was a knock on the door, and I admitted a young man of about 20.
And I admitted a young man of about 20, dressed in gray flannel slacks, two-tone shoes, a polka-dotted ascot, and a blazer with the badge of a Spokane high school.
His dark, shining hair
was a masterpiece of overcombing, the top hair laid back and crisscrossed with long side strands that just cleared the ears.
So then the young man meets Steinbeck and is struck by the fact that he's from New York City and wants to know more about New York City because he's so entranced about theater. And he says, well, you know,
there's no theater and no music and no one to talk to.
The burly proprietor's face was red as a raspberry when I went into the lunch counter.
Here Steinbeck meets the father of the young man.
He thrust his jaw at me. As if I ain't having enough trouble, you got to be from New York. Is that bad? For me it is. I just got that kid quieted down and you put burrs under his blanket.
The father talks about how ambitious Robbie is and that he took a course. And a course, he says, it's not barbering. Hairdressing for women.
For women.
Now maybe you see why
I got worries. Robbie turned from carving the ham. The slender knife was held rigidly in his right hand. He searched my face for the look of contempt he expected. I went through my beans and half my ham before I answered him. It is my considered opinion that the hairdresser is the most influential man in any community.
Steinbeck is trying to calm the father down, talking about how hairdressers have this ability with women because they share their confidence and they put their confidence and trust in them and tell them things that they don't tell anybody else. And he says to him, I'm not smiling when I say it.
I tell you that a clever, thoughtful, ambitious hairdresser wields a power beyond the comprehension of most men. Jesus Christ, you hear that, Robbie? Did you know all that?
The dad actually kind of responds to the fact that somebody has some respect for his son as somebody that actually doesn't find him embarrassing or just because he's gay, but finds something with integrity about what his son does. And I think it makes the dad feel good about his son for a moment. You know, it's hard for me to imagine what it would like to be Robbie in 1960. I mean, my own journey in the 80s was terrifying, so I'm sure how alone he must have felt, how scared, and how badly he just wanted to go away and get out of here and find people like him, you know, just to find his community.
$10 is fine.
I can't give you the extra one.
My relationship has evolved so much that it's kind of crazy.
My name is Francis L. Nickerson. Everybody calls me Nick.
All right. See you later, Nick. Thanks.
He's a barber. You know, he's 81 and works 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. Towards high school when I was, you know, kind of going out and doing things, and I think it became clear that I was gay and that I was, you know, seeing some boys and hanging out, and I think it really kind of had a wedge in between us.
And when I heard about it, I was a little bit devastated. I told him, I said, look, it's either one way or the other, and I prefer to go this way.
When I finally kind of came out and he found out, I actually took off and moved to Seattle, where I started beauty school, and I lived there for probably 6-7 months, and we really didn't talk until I think it was like a week before Christmas, and I called home, and I talked to my dad, and my brother was there, and he was just talking to me how much he missed me, and I was crying and telling him I missed him too, and my brother actually got in the car and drove to Seattle in a snowstorm, picked me up and drove me back home, and, you know, hugged, and, you know, and I've been here ever since. But it was still after that, it was still different, it was still unique. He didn't get it for a long, long, long time.
To me, in my era, see, that was a kind of a funny thing, you know. Well, I did a little studying, and I met some of these people, and some of the people in the theater, it's unbelievable how many of them people are same way, you know. And so I thought, well, it's either this or I'll lose him. I'm not going to lose him. No way. Okay.
Have a good day. You bet. My father is, you know, so amazingly proud of me and kind and wonderful in these past years. It's hard to even remember the man that he used to be. It's just so different. It's cool.
Like a program?
Thank you.
There you go. Enjoy the show.
Good evening. So I'm here to let you know what we're doing next year. We're opening the season with the Buddy Holly story, bringing back some of your favorite actresses in Nonsense. A White Christmas. Fun, kind of crazy farce, a lot like Noises Off, called Don't Dress for Dinner. And then I'll be directing to close the season, The Full Monty. So, yeah. Thank you for your support, and have a good night.
Oh,
heard from Troy Nickerson, an actor and theater director in Spokane, Washington. This is Travels with Mike, in search of America 50 years after Steinbeck. I'm Al Letson. From Spokane, Steinbeck and Charlie drove to Seattle, then turned left and headed down the Pacific coast. He wrote of camping among the redwoods. Steinbeck grew up in Northern California, so the great trees were familiar to him. But he still wrote about the sequoia in mysterious, almost alien terms. Meet Susan Tweet Burdick, a Yurok Indian basket maker in Humboldt County. She has a very different relationship with the redwoods.
Okay, so the fruit bowl, the materials that she used in here is willow root and also woodwardia fern that's dyed with alder bark. We're in the new library of College of the Redwoods. Most of this collection is, this is Yurok basketry. And then there's bear grass. The white in there is the bear grass. And the black in there is maidenhair fern. So we have, there's a lot of preparation into making just one basket. We have always had this from the time, from the beginning of time. And it's been passed on. And, you know, we've struggled. There's been massacres here. They took language away from us. And yet, we still can set and weave. We are on a scenic drive through Trinidad. And I'm looking over here and I'm trying to see if there's any huckleberries getting ripe. Huckleberries last month. I seen huckleberries ripe at Humboldt. Wow. Yeah, huckleberries are ripe. We're driving a Nissan, very small truck with a little lady and sitting in the back that has very little room, but this is how we do things here. We just make do with what what we have.
I again na netwaiti uchnahech krechas nani abchantenhech kumetwaiti womura Krista Richardson krechas nakrukwarar. What I said was, hello, my name is uchnahech, and my wide rim hat person name is Krista Richardson. I'm a Karuk person.
Okay, we're going to be into the redwoods here. You scare me, Koi. What do you want, huh? Oh, I just opened up. We pulled into the parking lot for the big tree and opened my door, and here's this blue jay flies up. And he's sitting up on my door. Not afraid of me at all. What you want? You got a message? Oh, just starving. My goodness. Oh, you guys got pretty blue feathers and all that pretty black feathers. Not too far back in time, the animals actually, they could speak like we spoke. We communicated with them. Big tree. From without glasses on, I can see that. The height is 287 feet. Diameter is 23.7 feet, and the approximate age is 1,500 years old. When John Steinbeck came here, I think that he has a different understanding about them. Christopher, come and read this. Or loan me your eyes, one of the two.
The redwoods, once seen, leave a mark or create a vision that stays with you always.
The redwoods, once seen, leave a mark or create a vision that stays with you always. No one has ever successfully painted or photographed a redwood tree. The feeling they produce is not transferable. From them comes silence and awe. It's not only their unbelievable stature, nor the color, which seems to shift and vary under your eyes. No, they are not like any trees we know. They are ambassadors from another time.
They are ambassadors from another time.
But they're not from another time. They're here, like we are. That's what I can't. think how he must have seen them.
Right.
And you can't take one thing from our environment and look at it as something anything any different than that fern growing there. Yes, they are very, very old, and they do live, you know, for a long, long time. But they're part of us as much as we are part of them. Just like the river now, you know, we're trying to get the dams removed. And I don't think people really realize that, but the river is only as healthy as the forest. The forest is only as healthy as what we give back to them. We take and they take. We give and they give.
Okay. I hope you don't mind walking, because I don't pay to come into this park. This is Patrick's Point. This is where our village is. It actually is a tourist attraction for this park, and we have to pay like anyone else to go in there. I refuse to pay. Okay, so we're going to go into Sumig Village. Now we need to get down the hill sometimes here. Anyway, this is one of our houses here. The regular house, or family house, women, kids lived in. Round entrance, and so you'd have to get down on your knees and you back into it. Up on the top, they have these shakes up there, these planks that come across that can be removed, and that's where the smoke comes out. And it's made of redwood. All of the houses on the coast here are made of redwood. So this is something that, again, that John Steinbeck didn't see when he passed through here.
Jai Ram, Jai Ram, Tun Vichas, Jai Ram.
I stayed 2 days close to the bodies of the giants. To me, there's a remote and cloistered feeling here. One holds back speech for fear of disturbing something. What? From my earliest childhood, I've felt that something was going on in the groves, something of which I was not a part.
When you take the time to really see, to really feel, we could talk to some people, you know, the rest of our life, and they would never realize what we're trying to say. They can't understand it because they've never been there. They've never felt it. They've never seen it. They've never heard it. They've never smelled it. Everything teaches you. Not only the redwoods.
Basket weaver Susan Tweet Burdick near Oreck, California, and her young friend singing there, Crystal Richardson. Just one more stop on our journey across country in the footsteps of John Steinbeck, his home territory, Monterey, California. When Steinbeck returned there in his travels with Charlie in 1960, you know, he hadn't been back in years, and what he saw appalled him. Our guide in Monterey today is a writer who loves and admires Steinbeck, but disagrees with him about change and about whether it's possible to go home again.
So we're in downtown Monterey, and the buildings themselves probably aren't much different from the ones that Steinbeck saw when he was growing up here in the area. He probably came to this cinema, the Golden State Cinema, Golden State Theater. Lots of gulls. That hasn't changed much. And if you inhale deeply, the ocean's to our left and behind us, all over there. You can sort of catch a scent of the sea breeze and kelp and rotting sea life. It's still there. I'm Diana Garcia. I'm a poet and writer and a professor in the Creative Writing and Social Action Program at California State University, Monterey Bay. So I'm reading from
Steinbeck's travels with Charlie in search of America. As part of his journey, he comes home again, and he goes to Johnny's bar, the Galician. And to Steinbeck's horror, he starts hearing the word dead, dead, dead after he brings up the names of several of the old-time friends. And that's around the time when he starts talking about Thomas Wolfe's concept that you can never go home again, that there's been too much change and it's not for the better. When he left, there was still a fishing industry. When he returned, that fishing industry was in tatters. The wharves were crumbling, the canneries were shut down, and he tells his friend Johnny, "Today I walked the length of Alvarado Street and back by the Calle Principal, and I saw nothing but strangers.
Nothing but strangers. My nerves are jangled by traffic lights. Even the police are strangers, foreigners." Johnny was slumped casually over the bar. "But here, Juanito, it's the same. We don't let them in." I looked down the line of faces. "Yes, here it is better. But can I live on a bar stool? Let us not kid ourselves. What we knew is dead, and maybe the greatest part of what we were is dead. What's out there is new and perhaps good, but it's nothing we know."
Steinbeck realized if the discussion continued, it was going to lead to a fight. Yet the next words were going to be, "Let's step outside and settle this." And so instead, he left. And later on talks about how he not only leaves Monterey, but in a sense flees Monterey.
"It's a lonesome old town."
This four-lane concrete highway slash with speeding cars.
Speeding cars, I remember as a narrow, twisting mountain road where the wood teams moved, drawn by steady mules.
This was a little town,
a general store under a tree and a blacksmith shop and a bench in front on which to sit and listen to the clang of hammer on anvil. Now little houses, each one like the next, particularly since they try to be different, spread for a mile in all directions. That was a woody hill with live oaks dark green against the parched grass where the coyotes sang on moonlit nights. The top is shaved off, and a television relay station lunges at the sky and feeds a nervous picture to thousands of tiny houses clustered like aphids beside the roads.
I've been reading Steinbeck since I was about 10 years old. He was the first author to make a deep impact on me. Growing up the child of farm workers, he talked about the Salinas Valley. He may as well have been talking about the San Joaquin Valley. He talked about agriculture, talked about the native peoples, talked about the Mexicans. It all sounded very familiar. It felt very like home to me. For me, this issue of coming home, I feel like I'm always coming home. I live so close to my parents in Merced. I've seen the orchards being torn down. I've seen the crops disked under. And then I've seen the forms being laid, the curbs and gutters and the driveways being poured. I've seen those changes, and I feel that I can go home because I've experienced them individually, minutely, over a period of time. They haven't come on me as a shock. You know, the freeway went through our part of town when I was about 12 years old, and it destroyed that entire community forever at that point. When that happened, I didn't see it as destruction at that time so much as work for my father, because he was one of the cement masons working on the abutments and the sidewalks and the overpasses. And so it's a very different reality. So now we're on Cannery Row itself, with the Cannery Row trolley tooling up and down the street, tourists crossing at their risks. We have the pizzerias, the beer joints, candy companies, and of course, we're standing right now in front of the bust of John Steinbeck, who immortalized Cannery Row with his book titled Cannery Row. You know, I don't know how much profanity Steinbeck used, but he's always struck me as kind of a working class kind of guy, and I'm sure that he would have had a few choice phrases for some of the changes that had occurred here in his hometown. I don't think he would have cared for it.
I don't see that for myself. We are always in a process of breaking down and building back up, both as humans and as an environment and as communities. If it weren't so, then we probably would cease to exist.
That's Diana Garcia, a poet and teacher in Monterey, California, in a conversation across time with the writer John Steinbeck. In the end, Steinbeck couldn't answer his own question, what are Americans like? He called his collected perceptions a barrel of worms. But he also wrote this.
From start to finish, I found no strangers. If I had, I might be able to report them more objectively. But these are my people, and this is my country. If I found matters to criticize and to deplore, they were tendencies equally present in myself. Americans are much more American than they are Northerners, Southerners, Westerners, or Easterners. California Chinese, Boston Irish, Wisconsin German, yes, and Alabama Negroes, have more in common than they have apart. The American identity is an exact and provable thing.
The passages from Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie were read by John Bewin, who also produced this program. To see photos of the artists you've heard in this hour and to hear an interview with a Steinbeck scholar about Travels with Charlie, visit travelswithmike.org. That's travelswithmike.org. I'm Al Ledson, and Travels with Mike in Search of America 50 Years After Steinbeck is a production of the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University and comes to you from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, at prx.org.
Every Wednesday from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m., you get to hear my signature format of the latest in jazz releases for the past 2 months. There's more, but as I like to say, it is all good. This is LaBeth, your jazz hostess. We enjoy a blend of music which I like to call the OG, a.k.a. the original jazz guru, along with the new releases. Listen to a variety of jazz sets along with my choice, the lady's choice. It's good to have you joining me, LaBeth, every Wednesday from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. at Jazz Montage.
The Henry Ford Centennial Library will temporarily be closed to the public from Monday, May 20th through fall 2019 for a major renovation project. In order to serve residents during this closure, both the Bryant Branch Library and the Esper Branch Library will be extending their hours beginning June 1st, 2019. Please visit DearbornLibrary.org for renovation updates and more detailed information regarding specific library services. Yeah.